What's up, you guys? I'm Andrea, and you're listening to Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Is doing well today. As you can tell, I do not have my dear co-host Haley with us. She is under the weather and she's fighting the big C, so she is not going to be with us today, and I am going to be doing this episode solo, which I know probably will upset some people, but the show must go on. Make sure you keep Haley in your thoughts and just send her some well wishes if you have a minute. I'm sure she would really appreciate it. She's actually doing pretty well, all things considered. She's just got the ick and not feeling too great. So she didn't want to record and just have it not be the greatest quality. So I'm here, Han Solo. And speaking of quality, I got a new mic. Hopefully it sounds glorious. I don't know what was going on with my other mic. I think it just decided to end it, just like Haley's did. We had a year with them. It was a good run, but their time has come to an end. So hopefully this sounds better. We do apologize for the shitty sound quality. Of course, when we decide to record 3 episodes, I have a shitty mic situation. So hopefully this sounds better, but let's go ahead and just jump into the case. This case is crazy. Up until I watched the Hulu special on it, I had no idea this case even existed, which kind of shook me because it is kind of a big deal. Like, it's a pretty big case, and the ending is so insane that I'm honestly surprised I've never heard of this. So today I am going to be covering the brutal murder of Betty Gore by the hands of Candy Montgomery. So if you guys have seen the Hulu special, it stars Jessica Biel. It is really good. Chef's kiss. Definitely check it out if you have Hulu. But without further ado, let's jump into the case. On Friday, June 13, 1980, Candy Montgomery brutally murdered Betty Gore with an axe. Candy struck Betty 41 times with a 3-foot-long axe in a fit of rage. What could possibly drive a suburban housewife to commit such a wicked crime? Candace Lynn Wheeler, better known as Candy, grew up moving from base to base throughout her childhood due to her father being enlisted in the Army. Candy eventually married a man named Pat Montgomery, who was an electrical engineer at Texas Instruments. In 1977, the Montgomerys moved to Collin County, Texas, and had 2 children, a son and a daughter. Candy was a full-time mom and known as a pillar of their community. The Montgomery social life revolved around the First United Methodist Church of Lucas. There, Candy met Betty Gore. Betty Gore was born in 1950 in a small town in Kansas. She had 2 younger brothers and moved to Texas with her family when she was a child. Betty was well-liked in school. She was described as being rather popular and outgoing. Betty went to college to become a school teacher, and there she met her future husband, Alan Gore. Alan was working as a teaching assistant in one of Betty's classes, and the 2 started dating in 1970 and eventually got married. Alan began working as an electrical engineer as well with a Dallas-based tech company. Following the birth of their first daughter, Alyssa, the family moved to Collin County, where Betty became a teacher at a local school in the county. In 1979, the 2 had another daughter, Bethany. Afterward, Betty suffered postpartum depression, which definitely put a strain on their marriage, unfortunately. At first, Betty and Candy hit it off rather well. The 2 women sang in choir together at First United, and they were both pretty involved in several activities at the church. Candy even threw a baby shower for Betty when she was pregnant with Bethany. And Candy's daughter was best friends with Betty's oldest daughter, so the 2 of them naturally spent a lot of time together. As I mentioned before, Betty appeared to have postpartum depression, which I imagine went pretty undertreated in the 70s and 80s. Occasionally, she would be, quote unquote, treated with a Valium to cope. Additionally, Betty began to fear being abandoned by Alan since he had started traveling for business trips, which was a requirement of his new job that he had just started. Betty began to resent Alan for this, and while Betty was resenting Alan for traveling with his new job, Alan began resenting Betty for his own reasons. According to Texas Monthly, the couple's sex life had taken a nosedive to almost nothing. When they did have sex, it was pretty much in order just to conceive. So back to Candy. Candy Montgomery was bored. She was bored with her mundane life and especially bored with her mundane sex life with Pat. She wanted fireworks. She craved excitement. She decided she should have an affair and for several weeks discussed having an affair with one of her other friends. Candy was looking for something to shake up her life. The precise moment Candy decided she wanted to have an affair with Betty's husband, Alan, was on the church volleyball court on a late summer day in 1978. Candy and Alan both tried to make a play on the same ball and collided. It was harmless, but for Candy, it brought on a revelation. Alan was very similar to Candy. They were both active in the church, outgoing, and seemed to be mismatched with their spouses' personalities. Alan helped organize the sports team at First United. He did all the things that Betty never seemed to be interested in or a part of. Alan liked to joke around with Candy more than he joked around with other women at the church. And sometimes after choir practice, the two of them would chat a little longer than necessary while everyone else left for the evening. The flirting was subtle, but as the weeks went by, Candy really started to fantasize about having sex with Alan. Finally, she decided to do something about it. One night, after choir practice, Alan was getting into his car, so Candy went up to the passenger side and opened the door. She leaned in and said, "Alan, I want to talk to you sometime about something that's been bothering me." Alan went on to ask, "Well, how about right now?" So Candy told him she'd been thinking a lot about him and how it was really starting to bother her, and she was uncertain whether she wanted to do anything about it or not. Alan was naturally confused about the context of this, so he just sat there silently. Candy proceeded to tell him she was attracted to him, and she was tired of just thinking about it, so she needed to let him know. Get it off her chest, you know? After this encounter, Candy got out of the car and quickly got into her car across the parking lot. Alan was in shock, but he was flattered by Candy's revelation. He wasn't, however, shocked at how forward Candy was because he had known her long enough to know that she spoke her mind, usually without hesitation. Subsequently, he was at a loss that another woman was interested in him sexually. He secretly was excited that it was Candy Montgomery. Before Candy and Alan began any sort of affair, Candy made a list of pros and cons, naturally like one does when they're planning to have an affair. I don't know. They also set up a set of rules to abide by. Those rules included avoiding becoming too emotionally invested. They would only meet on weekdays at a local motel. All of the expenses would be divided equally. Candy would provide lunch for the two since they would meet during Alan's lunch break. And lastly, if the affair became too risky, it would have to end. They then set the date for the affair to begin, which was December 12th, 1978. I don't know about y'all, but this sounds like too much work. They're like making dates, making pros and cons lists, like, I don't know. Seems a little much to me. So the morning of, Candy prepared for their encounter. First, she dropped off her daughter at the schoolhouse, and then she took her son to preschool. When she got back home, she prepared a special lunch for Alan and herself. She packed everything up, including a tablecloth, placed it all in a picnic basket, and then gathered a few undergarments and a sexy nightgown and put them all into her purse. She then drove down to the motel that was just a few minutes away from Alan's office where they had, you know, previously agreed to meet. They repeated this encounter every other week for several months. A couple of months in, Candy felt as though she was beginning to develop deeper feelings for Alan, which, y'all already know is a big no-no. It's a rule. So she told Alan how she felt and she thought that they should end things, but Alan convinced her to continue on business as usual. Which it is kind of business as usual because it's like a business transaction almost. But he told her that they were smart, they wouldn't allow their relationship to get too serious, and they needed to let it run its course. Which I feel like, of course he said that, you know. But then something changed. Betty and Alan decided to go to marriage counseling to try and repair their marriage. You know, they both knew they had some issues that they needed to work on, and they just thought, okay, you know, let's give this a try. They ended up attending the marriage encounter program that had been recommended by some friends of their church. Evidently, a lot of the friends from church were involved in this marriage encounter, and they all had, like, really good experiences with it. And so Alan kind of decided that he wanted to give it a shot, and he convinced Betty to attend with him. So after they attended the program, Alan felt guilty, and he decided that it was time to end his affair with Candy Montgomery. And he really wanted to strengthen the bond with his wife, which I commend him for that. I mean, he shouldn't have had an affair to begin with, but the fact that he was like, okay, like, I want to work on my marriage. This is worth fighting for. Let me end my affair, you know, instead of like having his cake and eating it too, which he obviously probably could have done for I don't know how long, but everything always catches up to you, so I'm sure his days were numbered. So when he told Candy, she wasn't particularly upset by Alan's decision, given that she reportedly was not thrilled with their subpar sex. Their affair lasted around 11 months and ended soon after Betty and Alan had their second child. Candy and Pat also attended a marriage encounter session, but they did not have the kind of life-changing experience that Betty and Alan seemed to have. But they did say that they enjoyed it. They didn't go back. They just had like one little session and then that was it. So now we're going to fast forward back to the night before Betty's murder. Alyssa Gore, which was Betty and Alan's oldest daughter, wanted to spend the night at the Montgomerys. Like I mentioned, she and Candy's daughter were really good friends, so she had planned to spend the night. And that week was vacation Bible school at First United, and everyone was pretty busy trying to keep the kids entertained. So Alyssa was spending the night with the Montgomerys, and she wanted to actually spend the night the following night as well. So Candy called Betty to, like, let her know, like, hey, Alyssa's going to spend the night again, you know, whatever. So the next day was Friday the 13th, 1980. Alyssa had swim lessons that day, and since she wasn't planning to spend the night with the Montgomery, she hadn't brought her swimsuit. So Candy offered to take her to the lesson and to go to her house and get her swimsuit. So she drove over to the Gore's house to pick up one of Alyssa's swimsuits from Betty. When Candy arrived at the house, the two women made small talk, you know, they caught up. Unexpectedly, Betty confronted Candy about the affair with Alan, even though it had been over for months. She said, "Candy, are you having an affair with Alan?" The details of what happened next are unclear, but according to later testimony by Candy, Betty picked up an axe that the Gores kept in their garage and came at Candy, threatening her with it, saying that she could not have Alan. Alan was hers, and she reportedly struck Candy's toe with the axe. There was a struggle, and Candy was able to wrestle the axe away from Betty. Experts testified that Betty was struck 41 times, and for the majority of those wounds Betty had received came after she was already unconscious, which, I mean, the amount of blood loss that she was probably experiencing, she probably lost consciousness pretty quickly. Candy then took a shower in the Gore's bathroom and left the house. Candy left behind 1-year-old Bethany alone and crying in her crib. So sad. She went by her house to replace her rubber sandals with a pair of tennis shoes. She laced them up tightly to keep pressure on the toe that she had bandaged up due to the injury from the axe. Candy then went on with her day as planned. She went back to the church and picked up her 2 kids along with Alyssa Gore. So Alan was currently in Minnesota away on one of his business trips, and he naturally worried about Betty because she hated being left alone, even if it was for one night. But he had high hopes that this trip would be easier on her since they were planning to go on vacation soon. Alan tried calling Betty several times throughout the day to let her know how things were going and to check on her, but he was unable to reach her. And he kind of started to grow a little bit concerned because from what he could remember, she was planning on staying home that day. And of course, you know, it's the 80s. There's no cell phones. There's no texting to keep track of your loved ones. So you got to call them on the house phone. And if they're there, they're there. If they're not, they're not. You don't get in touch with them. So he kind of backtracks in his mind to try to see if Betty had mentioned any plans that she had. And maybe that could explain why, you know, why she wasn't home all day, but he couldn't remember anything. But what he did know was that Betty would not leave home late in the evening without telling him where she was going. So by this point, it is the evening and Alan had had enough. So he decided he was going to call his neighbor, Richard Parker, who was also the real estate agent that sold them their home. When Richard answered, Alan told him that he was sorry for bothering him and asked if he minded going over and knocking on the door to see if Betty was home, just checking, making sure she's okay. Feeling a little imposed upon, he reluctantly agreed and he headed over to the Gore home, knocking, but no one answered. Alan then thanked him for checking and hung up. Then Alan calls Candy. He asked Candy if she'd seen or talked to Betty that day and that he was unable to get in contact with her, and she reassured him that Betty was probably fine and that she had seen her earlier that morning. She told him that she had gone over to pick up Alyssa's swimsuit because she was planning to spend the night again, and she had spent the night before. She even offered to go over and check on Betty, but Alan declined, saying that he'd just have the neighbor go check on her again. The two finished their conversation and hung up. Around 10 p.m., Alan tried Betty again and still no answer. This really bothered Alan because he knew Betty liked to get to bed around this time, and there's absolutely no way that she would still be out because she didn't even like to go out later in the evenings, period. So he decides to phone Richard again and asked if he would be willing to go check on her once more, and he did. This time, however, he noticed that both of the Gore's vehicles were there and that the lights inside were on, but still no one answered the door. He got a pit in his stomach. He told Alan, and Alan gave him permission to do whatever it took to enter the house and check things out. Alan then called another neighbor, an older gentleman by the name of Jerry McMahon, and asked if he'd be willing to check things out with Richard and explain the situation. Jerry agreed, but Jerry's wife was nervous and told him to ask a third neighbor to come over as well, Lester Gaylor. So Lester obliged and met the other two men at the Gore home. They began to try and find a way to enter the house, and Richard thought, hey, maybe I'll try to use my realtor key to see if it by chance still works. So he made his way to the front door, and there he made a chilling discovery. The front door was unlocked, and the door swung right open. The three men, apprehensive, entered the home and began looking for Betty immediately. First, they found baby Bethany crying hoarsely, covered in her own excrement. She had clearly been there for a long time. Richard then quickly gathered up the baby and took her next door to his wife to care for. Larry then went to the door of the utility room and opened it. There, lying in a massive pool of her own blood, laid Betty. He told the other two men not to go in, and the phone rang, and it was Alan. Jerry spoke with him and told him the situation was not good. He reassured him Bethany was okay, but Betty was dead. He went on to tell him it appeared that she had been shot with a gun, a shotgun to be exact, due to the condition of her head and body. That was the only reasonable explanation. He told Alan he needed to come home right away, and then he called 911. An autopsy would later determine that Betty had been struck 41 times and 28 of those blows were to her head and face. I cannot imagine what those men saw, what those investigators saw. Horrific. Investigators believe due to the brutal nature of her murder, it was likely her killer knew her. Former chief of physical evidence, Dr. Irie Stone, said, quote, "It was a vicious set of blows to the body, the face, the arms, the head, the torso, even into the legs. It was obvious to investigators that the killer had tried to clean up the crime scene, but gave up when they realized there was so much blood. They did, however, find a bloody thumbprint on the freezer, as well as a bloody shoe print in the laundry room." Alan, of course, was brought in for questioning despite his solid alibi, and he did eventually confess to having an affair with Candy Montgomery. According to Oxygen.com, detectives brought Candy in for more questioning because she had originally been questioned and, you know, claimed she had nothing to do with the murder, and they believed her and they sent her on her way. So they brought her back in for questioning later that day, and she still maintained that she had nothing to do with the murder. She was asked to take a polygraph test, but refused, which we all know polygraph tests are not the most reliable, but back in the 80s, I'm sure they were like the end-all be-all of evidence. But they were, however, able to compare the fingerprint and the footprint found at the crime scene, and that was enough to secure an arrest warrant. So on June 27th, 1980, Candy Montgomery was arrested and charged with the murder of Betty Gore. The trial lasted 8 days and was held in the Old County Courthouse in McKinney Square. It fit 200 people and was packed for the entire 8 days of the trial. Like, everyone in town showed up to witness this go down. The jury consisted of 3 men and 9 women. On the first day, Candy's lawyer, Don Crowder, shocked the court saying his client would plead self-defense. Since Candy claimed Betty came at her first and she was simply defending herself, but what about the severity of the attack? She struck that woman 41 times. And that, to me, seems to go beyond self-defense. But for that, Crowder brought in a Houston psychiatrist, Dr. Fred Faison, who testified that Candy had a dissociative reaction. They had previously put Candy under hypnosis, where she had divulged an abusive encounter with her mother, where she had been struck with a sharp object, which left her bleeding badly. When she cried out, her mother shook her and then raised her finger to her lips and said, "Shh." Candy claimed during the attack, Betty shushed her as they struggled with the axe, and it triggered this extreme reaction for her. That in her dissociative rage, she was completely unaware of how many times she hit Betty with the axe, or that she even was striking her with it to begin with. The jury accepted Candy's self-defense plea, and they acquitted her of all freaking charges on October 29th, 1980. So she got off, y'all. She did not go to jail for this murder. An axe murder. She did not go to jail. What? So one juror, Alice Doherty Rowley, said the number of blows didn't factor into their decision. She said, quote, "We determined it never had a bearing on the verdict at all, whether it was one gunshot or 1,000 whacks." The verdict received major criticism from the community. After the trial, crowds chanted, "Murderer, murderer," as Candy exited the courthouse. Betty's father, Bob Pomeroy, even spoke out and said, quote, "As far as I'm concerned, justice will be served. She has to live with it. I wouldn't say I was happy with the verdict. We don't know what really happened, and we never will know what happened." 3 months after the trial, Candy and Pat Montgomery moved to Georgia, but they later divorced. Candy now goes by the last name Wheeler, which is her maiden name. According to an article on History versus Hollywood, Candy went on to work with her daughter as a mental health therapist, counseling teens and adults who suffer from depression. Candy is now 72 and has had no other issues with the law. Not long after the trial, Betty's widower, Alan Gore, left Texas and remarried. He unfortunately lost custody of his children to Betty's parents. He has since divorced his second wife and is reportedly living in Sarasota, Florida, and has reconnected with his children. And that is the completely fucked up case. Shook it to the core. No rhyming intended. Betty Gore and Candy Montgomery. I, like, cannot believe that she got away with that. And I don't know. I don't know how I feel about when people say they, like, black out in a fit of rage and they, like, don't remember what happened. And, I mean, I guess your brain can do crazy things. I mean, I've learned that in psychology. Like, your brain can just take over and do whatever it wants, pretty much. And as someone who has anxiety and, like, can't stop a, you know, anxiety attack or a panic attack, like, I can kind of see how something like that could go down, but at the same time, I just have a hard time. Like, you can't prove it. So it's like, anyone could say that, but no one can prove it, unfortunately. But that bitch got away with it, so good for her, I guess. But I don't know. That case is like, I cannot believe I've never heard of this case, because it is fucked. Like, royally. But I hope you guys liked this solo episode. I know some of y'all don't vibe with me, so if you listened this far, thank you. I will put a little blooper at the end, because while I was recording, my son came in here, and I don't want to leave it in the beginning of the episode, but I might put it right here so you guys can laugh at me freaking out. And if you like... Oh my god, Manny! But... as always, make sure you're following us on Instagram and Facebook, Inhuman Podcast. We will be posting pictures of Betty, Candy, Alan, the whole shebang, the whole kit and caboodle. If you've watched this show, I would love to know what you thought about it. I thought Jessica Biel did an excellent job. Let me just tell y'all, I might ruin this for y'all, but Justin Timberlake makes a little guest appearance. So, I chuckled. So definitely check the show out if you are interested in this case and you like those kind of shows. It's very like 80s, 70s, southern, whatever. But yeah, so that's all I have for you guys today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll catch up with you guys on Monday with an all new episode, and hopefully Haley will be back by then. I'm sure she will. But until next time, keep it human. Bye.